Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 years war.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered.
Hello there, history friends, and welcome to another collaboration episode. A collaboration episode with a twist, because unlike all of the other collabs, this one was not done through Skype. This one was literally done one-on-one in person. Was it intimidating? Was it different? Sure. I mean, I had to grow, I had to kind of stretch and meet this guy one-on-one and talk to him as if I'm talking to a normal person, which is somewhat challenging. I also had to worry about all the usual technical things in person, which I could normally hide if it's from Skype. But yeah, he had a coffee from an exclusive When Diplomacy Fails mug. He shared a macaroon with me, and we had a great conversation. Who is this guy? Who on earth is Turtle Bunbury? If you haven't heard of him, if you have heard of him, then you must be pretty excited right now to hear a conversation with yours truly and Turtle Bunbury. But if you don't know who he is, Turtle Bunbury is one of Ireland's most renowned historians and genealogists. He's appeared on everything from RTE, which is Ireland's state broadcaster, to the BBC, which obviously needs no introduction, to radio programs, documentaries, all sorts of things. He has his own projects going. He's an accomplished author and, as I said, genealogist. And he also happens to be a stand-up guy who really helped me out by coming on this podcast. I really hope to use him. Well, that sounds bad, but I really hope to take advantage. That also sounds really bad. I hope to, how do I say it, channel his expertise. There we go, that sounds far better. I hope to channel Turtle Bunbury's expertise and, well, help him help me to make history thrive. Because, yeah, that's what we're all about. And that's what Turtle Bunbury's all about. By the way, if you're wondering about his name, we address that in the episode. To those of you who haven't heard of Turtle Bunbury, you're in for a treat. And to those of you that have, well, you're in for a treat too. I know they say don't meet your heroes, but hey, if you're a fan of Turtle Bunbury, you'll be happy to know that he's a pretty good guy. He's a history friend, just like me. Just like you, because you're listening to this podcast. And you're listening to this exclusive interview with Turtle Bunbury. Because we're running wild, guys. This is 5 weeks to run wild. This is When Diplomacy Fails' fifth birthday, and I'm so glad to have you all here for it. This is just an example of the kind of thing we are doing here at When Diplomacy Fails. And it's really a big reason why I was so excited to present this to you guys for so long. Not just this episode, but or even this collaboration episode, but all the other ones that go along with it. That kind of distinguish this project from so many others that have come before. Taken alone, it's an incredible interview. We talk about loads of different things, from why studying history is important to why, well, people should study history and not abandon it in school, to his plans for history, to his plans for being an author, to his experiences in being a freelance historian. He's a great guy and he gives us some great advice, and I hope you'll let him know what you thought by going to his website, turtlebunbury.com, or I hope you'll go and find him and let him know what you thought at turtlebunbury on Twitter, and find him on Facebook as well. Like his Wistorical page. That's basically just replacing the H from historical with a W. So go and do that. Go and support him. Go and tell him you enjoyed his presence on this podcast, because he's doing great service to us, guys. He really is. I mean, those of you who have never heard of him probably don't realize what a solid he did for me. So I really, really appreciate it. He is, as they say in some terrible sectors of this world, a good skin. And I really appreciate what he did. So thanks for listening, guys. And I hope you enjoy it too. Alrighty, the next voices you hear are myself and the one and only Turtle Bunbury. Okay, history friends, back on the podcast, and I have a very special guest today. I am joined by Ireland's finest, Mr. Turtle Bunbury. How's it going, Turtle?
Good day, Zach.
Thanks very much for joining us. How are we?
We are very good on a gorgeous day, it has to be said.
Very, very nice day. Very nice. We got some things to cover. I kind of want to go through, well, it's kind of hard to define this episode in a way. I mean, we're going to look at everything from why is history important to why you love history so much to kind of why we all should love history so much. So, yeah, I think we'll just kind of get right into it. I think one of the questions I would have straight away, because people who don't know you or who haven't heard of you, I think the thing they would probably think instantly, and you've probably gotten this before, is where does the name Turtle come from? And as someone whose surname is Twomley, and I often get asked about it, I feel like as people who have names that people might question, we can kind of...
Yes, we can relate yeah. to one another, Zach Twomley. Yeah. That is true. Yeah, it is... Turtle Bunbury, I forget how weird it is sometimes when running along with it, especially as I'm now a 45-year-old historian trying to be taken seriously. It is, you know, and it has its own strange stories, but you have asked nicely, so I'll tell you the real one is basically... my father was something of a Latin boffin,
okay.
and I am the third son. And as a child, I would come crawling around the house after my two older brothers, and he would count us into the room: Primus, Secundus, and here comes Tertius. I know that sounds very uber pretentious in its own funny way, but my brother started calling me Turtle, and then it stuck, and I tried to shake it off as a teenager. Yeah. And it never happened, and
okay.
so eventually I said, oh, well, to hell with it, I'll stick with it.
Okay, yeah, nice. No, that's good. That's actually got a nice story behind it, because my mom was like, whatever you do, make sure you ask him where Turtle, because she's so curious, and like I was curious as well, and no, it's nice to know that, because as someone who kind of has an unusual name, sometimes it is a help, because you don't forget. Like, you're not going to forget Turtle Bunbury. So, in that way, it's good, really.
That is, yes, I suppose that is a benefit, and certainly if you're trying to, you know, put books out there and all the rest of it, that is a benefit. There are alternative stories doing the rounds that I can turn my head 360 degrees, that I was conceived in the Galapagos and all sorts of things.
But anyway. Yeah. Well, it's good to see that you are coming out of your shell. And I just had to get in there. Sorry about that. Well, like, speaking of names as well, Bunbury itself, I mean, that's got a fascinating history behind it, doesn't it?
I mean, the Bunbury family claim, and I think we all have to be a little bit dubious about family claims, but we claim to descend from a French guy called Baron de Saint-Pierre, who came over to with William the Conqueror to fight at the Battle of Hastings.
Right.
And was given land in a place called Boniface's Borough in Cheshire. And for which his son became the Lord of Boniface's Borough, and then over a couple of generations it changed from Boniface's Borough to Bonnyborough to Bonnyborough to Bunbury. And that's where that came from.
Nice.
And then they were very good at picking up wealthy brides for a few generations, which definitely helps. And there was a guy called Roger Bunbury, or de Bunbury, who was a marshal in the Black Prince's army. And another guy... Richard de Bunbury, who fought, well, he was meant to fight at Agincourt, but he brilliantly pulled a sickie that morning, which I think is a very skillful thing to do.
Yes, very good.
And had he gone out there, he'd probably been munched. I wouldn't be here boring your listeners 800 years later, whatever. So they basically were based in Cheshire for a long time, and then they were, at the time of the English Civil War, actually, there was a guy here during the Elizabethan age who was down in Lismore Castle. He was tied up with that in the 1580s, which is a pretty fascinating era for me. And then in the 1650s, Sir Harry Bunbury was a supporter of Charles I.
Okay.
For which he was flung in prison and had his house burned down and all his lands ravished.
Right.
And he, his children legged it. One to Virginia and the other to Ireland.
Oh, right.
And so I'm from the Irish
descendants. Did he get to keep his head in the end?
He kept his head, which is an unusual thing.
That is unusual then, yeah. They weren't very fond of letting people
keep. His first cousin was in Sir John Aston, was it? Who was up at Drogheda.
Okay.
Who was clubbed to death with his own leg, famously, up to the end of the siege.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, hardcore.
Yeah, they didn't hold back then. Right. Did your kind of, because it sounds like you would have looked into that a good bit, did kind of researching your own family's history, like, give you a good basis from which to think, hey, I enjoy doing this, I might do this for other people, kind of thing?
I definitely think learning, you know, getting to grips with your own family history, obviously I was incredibly, incredibly lucky having a backstory that goes back that far, but it puts the sort of generations in context, and it means, I think when you study any family history, you go back in time, and you don't know where you're going to end up, because maybe your great-great-grandfather did, you know, this job, or serve in the army, or serve in civil service, or whatever. But maybe his brother emigrated to Brazil, or served in a polar exploration, or emigrated to Tennessee.
Yeah.
You don't know. So you end up going down those journeys and those routes, the unpredictable. Definitely. Family history, I think, is an incredibly good way to get started, because it's in a way more accurate than just focusing in on a war or an event.
Yeah, because you actually have to find the people, kind of thing.
Yeah, and you also have to look at what age the people were when these events happened. So one of my ancestors was born in 1800, and so you're able to say, right, well, he was 15 with the Battle of Waterloo, you know, he was 29 when Catholic Emancipation came into Ireland.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and it puts it in context.
Okay, cool, yeah. It's good to be able to look at it like that, but I mean, did you always have an interest in history? Like, can you remember back to a time when you thought, I really like history, I think I want to pursue this kind of thing?
Pretty earliest memories. As a kid, I was hooked on scripture stories, which arguably are, you know, a foundation of history. I loved all those tales, but unfortunately I lacked one of the important things to become a clergyman, which is a certain amount of belief. I then, you know, had good history teachers at school, which is absolutely vital.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So important.
And then growing up in a historic house surrounded by portraits and items and furniture and things and lots of books, that totally sowed it in me. So, yeah, I have been a proper historical bore since I was about 3 years old, I think.
Oh, that's good. It's good. It's good to have a foundation in it. I think from my experience, when I first realised that I really, really wanted to learn and, like, study history in more detail, probably for, like, the Leaving Cert, where I had to write, like, the history exam, and it's very kind of time-sensitive. But being Zach, I decided to just gush about all I knew. And then when I got out of the exam, it was then I kind of realized, do you know, I feel like I have a lot to say, and maybe pursuing this at a different level would be good, because then I wouldn't be constrained by all these time limits.
Examination papers.
Yes, yeah. And then, of course, I started a podcast, and I haven't shut up about history since. So
joy to the world.
Exactly. I mean, maybe just talk a little bit about your career, kind of as a historian, as a historian, as a kind of genealogist kind of thing. You're, in terms of just like workload, you've produced, is it 13 books now?
The new book is, I think, the 13th of those books. I did quite a lot of privately commissioned books as well, which
puts
a slightly different ball game. So I after school and all that malarkey, I went to Trinity College in Dublin to read law initially, and hated it. And then we fell out with each other, me and Law, and I changed direction. And actually, a friend of mine said, well, I don't see why you're not studying history. So I moved to the history department at Trinity.
Yeah.
And to my great joy, I suddenly found myself learning about Ireland in the age of the Vikings and the Tudors and all this stuff. Loved it in heaven. But I still didn't think I was going to become a historian at that stage. And I probably enjoyed myself, at college more than, I wasn't a brilliant student, I wouldn't have said.
Right.
I then went off for a few years. I became a travel writer. And I lived in Hong Kong for just under 3 years and came back. I moved back into history then on various fields, as you mentioned, doing genealogy. So I started doing family histories for specific families. And then a project called Vanishing Ireland as well, which is...
Yes, I saw a few of them, yeah.
So that was something, a lovely project that basically involves travelling the length and breadth of Ireland with a great buddy of mine, a brilliant photographer called James Fennell, and we were tracking down old-timers in their 80s, 90s, 100s, and interviewing them for, spend maybe an hour or 2 hours with each one, and James would get a brilliant photograph, and I'd ask them about their life stories and also about... what their, I suppose, inherited oral tradition was from the generations before.
Yeah.
Which would sometimes bring you back to the 18th century. Wow. Nuts.
Yeah.
But a lovely project to work on.
Yeah, and I figure, one of the things I'd love to do, and the reason why I love doing interviews like this, and I'd love to do more in the future, is because if you get people who have been around longer, they're such a great resource. Read a book and that kind of thing, but sometimes the personal accounts, you just can't beat them. Do you find that it kind of really gives you a window into the era that you wouldn't have had otherwise?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the latest book I did was called 1847, A Chronicle of Genius, Generosity and Savagery, which is set against the black drop for in Ireland, of course. It was Black 47, the worst year of the Irish famine.
Yeah.
But when talking to the old-timers for the Vanishing Ireland project, it was amazing how many of them, their grandparents were... children, if not teenagers, at the time of the famine in the 1840s. So suddenly you're that close to the events from the past. I can't remember what it is. I think it's 285 year olds ago. Is that right? 285 year olds ago brings you to 1847. So we're really close to that. Go 385 year olds, and you're it's the French Revolution.
Yeah,
not yet underway.
Yeah,
So history is really funny in that sense. Definitely hearing it firsthand from people is very rich.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's fair to say that, judging from your back catalogue, we talked about Vanishing Ireland and stuff, would you say that Irish history is maybe not your forte, but your kind of preferred realm?
It's certainly, obviously, it has been up till now. I've strongly focused on that. But even with the most recent book, 1847, I wrote quite a few chapters that had nothing to do with Ireland at all, including the story of a warlord from Kazakhstan and the Comanches of Texas and various other stories set in St. Petersburg. Because I think that we are, it's a really lovely aspect of being a historian is you can actually, it's like being a travel writer, which I was for a while.
Yeah.
You can go to places anywhere
and
delve deep. I mean, you go back into the Franco-Dutch War.
Yeah.
It's not, the landscape is roughly the same. The town names are the same, but most everything else is completely different.
Yeah.
And yet you can sort of put yourself in there and get a feel for it.
Mm.
And I think that is the same with that. And it's really exciting to go to these other countries, to talk about Bernardo O'Higgins in Chile, which I've also been enjoying researching a little bit lately. Which is, I haven't even been to Chile.
Mm.
Now, I wouldn't pretend, I think you miss out on a lot of the nuances, of course, is if you did live in Chile and talked to Chilean people, you're going to get a much broader picture.
Mm.
But I think I'm interested in history, full stop.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to be strictly Irish.
Oh, good, good. Because I find sometimes we know the kind of more famous, not more famous, but renowned. The likes of Dermot Ferriter, for example, who's on RD an awful lot. So he would be kind of seen as an Irish historian. But I don't know. I think for me as well, I think there's just so much value in looking at as many kind of different parts of history as possible. So, and I was never able to tie my own interests down anyway. So even if I wanted to just look at Irish history, or even just Louis XIV's era, for example, literally impossible for me to do so because... I don't know about you, but whenever I look into things in the podcast, I'm always thinking, okay, I can definitely cover that next time kind of thing. Is that true with you? Say, like, you mentioned some chapters that you did for 1847. Would they kind of propel you onto those eras to maybe look at them, say, more detail for another book, perhaps, or...?
Possibly. I mean, there's tangents galore to be had, yeah. which I do love. And yes, I kind of have, you know, gone back in time. In fact, I have an interest in the 1740s, you know, and seeing what was going on in the world in that period. Mm. Not sure if I'll do a book on it yet, but I might. I'm building sort of, you know, the stories into that. because, yeah, I think the knock-on effect from an event. So, you know, that's the 1740s is the time of the Jacobites, of the Gin Wars, which I think are absolutely fascinating area, and Handel's Messiah and stuff. So you've got a lot of, you know, very colourful tales going on. But the knock-on effect of, you know, how that impacts everything right up to American and French revolutions and indeed Irish, the United Irishmen, you know, as you have definitely... worked out, there are always long-term causes and short-term causes.
And I think as well, like, even the 1740s, like, Frederick the Great was running around then. I mean, like, he, like, there was wars going on in the continent that Britain was getting involved in, not getting involved in, like, Prussia was expanding, Poland was declining, all sorts of stuff are going on. So, yeah, I think my problem almost is that I've never been able to define myself as a specific historian. I'm just kind of like, I like history, leave me alone kind of thing. But we mentioned like books and that kind of thing, but I mean, you have a few other side projects going on as well. I mean, you have Wistorical. Is that, that's the correct way to pronounce
that it? That is the correct way to pronounce it, yeah. Wistorical, which is a sort of still slightly fledgling project, but it was... a bit like when diplomacy fails, it's trying to look at ways of bringing the historical, you know, to a broader audience through different means and different ways. So Historical was the idea. I wanted to create an app that would tell people the history of where they are standing.
Oh, wow.
But it is a big, massive project
of course.
To engage in.
Yeah.
And you then try and work out the financial returns on it, which tend to be fairly dwindling.
Yeah.
So it has a Facebook you know, presence, which I monitor and update fairly regularly. But, you know, that was one side of things. But I do think it's important to... As a historian, I think it's very important to try and keep on top of, you know, the futuristic ways that technology can try and help.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why, the reason why I love podcasting is because it's not quite like, I mean, like with books, like, and not to say podcasting doesn't take a lot of effort or time or anything like that, but you can be fairly current. Like, if something comes up, you can address it. Or if something comes to your mind, it's easier to release a half-hour podcast than it is to, like, do a whole book. So I think like the likes of like using social media with which is what Historical is on, so it's just very handy to be able to make use of, well, technology really. I mean, you must be able to like admit, like with the likes of podcasting and being able to use social media, it's just so handy to be able to bring history to people in ways that, say, like even 10 years ago wasn't really even
one,
possible.
Absolutely. And it gets, you know, well beyond the confines of your locality as So a lot of Historical, and there's a Vanishing Ireland Facebook page as well, and a lot of the followers for them would be from, I mean, a huge number, 40-50% are from the US, for instance, and they both have, I think, 22,000 followers, you know, so there's quite a sizable chunk of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, yeah. I think When Diplomacy Fails has been set at, like, 2,200 likes for, like, a good while now, so...
Oh, we'll have to bump it up.
Yes, we will, won't we? Yes, indeed. I mean, it's not, you're not... literally not tied down by things you may or may not have produced. I mean, we've talked about Historical, we talked about your books and stuff, but you're fairly active just like literally producing things. I believe you were in Cork relatively recently, were you?
Yes, I've just literally just opened an exhibition down there last month, which was it's called A City by the Sea, and it is a maritime history of Cork Harbour and Port and the River Lee, all the way out to Cove, Queenstown. That was and yeah, so that is, and it's a, you know, it's because it's one of the world's biggest natural harbours, and there's immense amounts of history going back into
of
people
course.
Stuck up sort of you know, stone circles and so forth that are around and about. But particularly for the last 400 or 500 years, it's very rich, and even This year they are gearing up to mark the 1917, the US entry into the war.
Yeah.
And how Cork Harbour became the main one of the main bases for the US Navy.
Yeah, yeah.
When they were launching their systems to try and get rid of the German U-boats and all that malarkey.
Yeah.
So there is masses going on down in Cork City. Yeah. It's a very interesting project.
Okay, well, what kind of drew you? Like, I'm always interested to find out, like, what draws you into certain kind of topics. I mean, you're not obviously not from Cork, but I mean, you kind of did that just kind of come up, and you thought that'd be interesting to look into more, or?
Well, there are networks of people that you start meeting when I basically, as a freelance historian, I have at any one moment I have about 40 balls in the air because 38 of them will fall flat on the ground.
Right, right.
One of them's still up there, and maybe you catch one. That was basically how that came about. It was, I know that they're having a big push to try and push the connection between Cork Harbour and Cork City.
Sure,
this is a little distance, it's sort of 8 miles between them. I was down there about 4 or 5 years ago doing a historical report on it. And then this church, St. Peter's Church in Cork, said that they wanted to do an exhibition, and I said, "Well, I'm your man." And luckily, it was all lovely.
Great,
worked out nicely.
Great. Okay. You mentioned they're a freelance historian, and I think for many people who study history or who want to study history, I think if academia isn't what they go into, they like the idea of becoming a freelance historian. But obviously, it's very difficult because there's all sorts of things. I mean, like, you really have to promote yourself, don't you, essentially?
It is blatant self-promotion, yes, which helps if you need to change your name to Bunbury or something of that nature. You have to. I mean, it is, I think it's a really lovely, interesting, very varied life. It is difficult to find massive remuneration in the early stages, maybe, where you and I, Zach, will be very hopeful that that doesn't stay the case the course of our lifetime.
But, absolutely.
It is very interesting. There's, no 2 days are the same. But I think you have to explore every medium. You need to, of course, be looking at all the online availabilities. You've got to try and figure out whether TV is the world for you, whether radio is the world. I ran a history festival for 3 years down in Carlow, which is a terrific event, very time-consuming, but actually it put me in contact with a lot of the leading historians in Ireland.
Brilliant.
And actually quite a few from the UK and other places, which was extremely interesting project for myself. And then I take tours, I give talks, I write books, I do a lot of articles for newspapers. I think you've just got to do, everything to keep going, because you never know which one of those is actually going to become your forte.
Very true. Yeah. And Anna always, my wife, by the time people are listening to this, but she always says that I have a brass neck. The expression, because I'm constantly like putting myself out there. Like, one example that she was horrified, I went to a bookshop in Wexford, and within talking to the lady behind the counter in the space of about 10 minutes, I'd already given her a key ring and a pen and told her all about the...
Quite right, that's what we must do.
Yeah. I mean, I think the medium or even the discipline of history, it depends on... But I think that's what puts people off the idea of... And I think we'll come back to this, but academia in history is very closed off. So when people want to do a future, they're thinking of a career in history, they think, well, if I'm not the kind of personable guy who can really put myself out there, or maybe I'm too kind of self-conscious or embarrassed. But I used to think that way, but the remarkable thing is I just kind of, it was like I became 25 and then suddenly I didn't have any shame anymore or something. It was mad. But thankfully it's not something that bothers me, and I think the more that I've done podcasting, the more I've kind of been able to see myself, not necessarily as an independent or freelance historian, because I'm not like taking work and I work for the Leprosy Mission anyway, but I don't know, I think what is your opinion kind of on podcasts for the discipline of history? Do you think, I mean, hopefully you think they're a good thing, I would imagine, yeah.
Be glad to know. I think they're a very good thing. Yeah, I really think that they are the way people are going. 100%. I know lots of people who do lots of long drives around Ireland now who look forward to the drives because they can listen to a podcast of their chosen subject. And these happen to be friends of mine who enjoy history. So they're going online listening to, history.
Which
is, you know, a very extraordinary time we live in where we can actually choose what you want to live in, listen to during
Isn't
a long
it?
Journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so from that perspective, the podcasts are great. And then you've also got the other side, the smaller, shorter things, which my daughters, who are 8 and 9 and their generation, are definitely going to be interested in, which is 1 minute.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Long history lessons, but they'll listen, they'll watch it,
yeah.
And you can maybe start, you know, hooking them in, reading them in that way. So yeah, technology, you gotta work with it and make it your tool, but I think podcasts definitely are the way to go.
Yeah, big time. Oh, I feel the same way. But I mean, with being a freelance historian, is your independence very important to you in the sense that you don't really have to answer to anyone except maybe, like, say, the tax man or something?
I think, and one of the things I learned, and I hope I'm doing much better at it than I think you do have to answer to somebody. You have to answer to credibility. And that means that you can't put something out there that turns out to be baloney.
Of course.
Because then you are shot.
Yeah.
And certainly in my early days when I was sort of starting out and I was kind of moving from travel writer to historian, I probably fell for, you know, a few stories and legends and thinking that they were true. And then actually, funny enough, I did quite a lot of, feature writing for newspapers where they would hire me to, you know, write up this story, and then you go and investigate and you discover that it didn't happen. But anyway, the point is that, I think you have to be very, you have to just check your sources and state your sources and know where you're coming from on that front.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, would you ever feel tempted to enter into academia? Could you picture yourself giving lectures to people in that kind of sense?
Yeah, I mean, I do a little bit of lecturing, but I mean, that's mainly sort of genealogy classes down in UCC every now and then in Cork. And at the University of Limerick I have as well. But I actually am definitely interested in going to an American university. I'm talking to one at the moment just for a couple of semesters to go over there with my wife and daughters and just enjoy a bit of US life, and if they'll have me, and give some lectures in their Irish studies department.
Oh, brilliant.
I think, you know, a little bit of that, definitely. We'll see how it works. Academia.
Good.
I don't know if they'll have me. I wasn't a great academic when I was at college, but I'm trying harder.
Yeah. I think a lot of the times as well, another thing that I find interesting, it's almost like the lines between, like, it's not really the case anymore that in order to be an academic, you have to be like, wear a strange jumper, surround yourself with dusty books, and be kind of very not very inspiring to people. I think that kind of era has ended. It seems now, not even just with TV, like, we have historians on TV and we have people who are like in the public eye more. And I think people will listen to, I don't want to call them popular historians because I know that they are qualified, but I don't
think that there's as much of a kind of, oh, you didn't go to Cambridge or Oxford to get your first class PhD, so therefore you can't tell me what's what in history kind of thing. Do you think that's accurate, or do you think maybe history as a discipline kind of needs more people with big giant degrees? Is that...
No, I spent a year studying history at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands.
Oh yeah, I pronounced that wrong about 500 times. Oh,
It's a tricky one. But there was a wonderful lecturer there from Virginia, UVA, I think he was, called Edward Ayres. And I remember him coming in and just blowing me away with his presentation skills. Yeah. And, you know, he just had us all hooked, mesmerized. Mm. We wanted to stay in that room for, you know, 7 hours straight listening to him. And I think that has to be, you know, because I'm afraid the converse was true with some of my other lecturers where, you know, you just... didn't even really want to go because it's just going to be an uncomfortable bed.
Yeah, exactly.
For the next hour. So I think that is absolutely key to keeping people interested. And, you know, in history, as far as I can work it, I cannot ever understand how it could be boring because you are playing with everything that's ever happened.
Of course.
All the people that have ever lived in all the countries and all the romance and drama and tragedy and everything.
Absolutely.
So it should, and especially in this day and age, I would have thought with the possibilities of creating really stirring slideshows, bringing it all to life with visual imagery as well for lecturers. It should be a very exciting time to be a history student.
Yeah, I would think so as well. I think the problem is, I mean, with this, there's a certain stigma attached to history. Like in my experience in UCD, I think there was about 500 history students in my class. And then it wasn't until I did the master's when there was like 30 people that I felt like I was surrounded by more like-minded people. And even then I was the biggest nerd in the class. But I mean, like...
Surely not, Zach.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think I set the bar for nerdism very high, but what my question kind of is, I don't know, do you think that when people look at history, they might think, oh, there's no kind of career there? And do you think that there's, if you're not going to become an academic and you're not the kind of person who could really see themselves as a freelance historian, is there much reason to do a history degree if you're not necessarily going to use it in your career, really?
I know plenty of people who studied history and didn't take it on. I mean, I didn't even mean to take it on myself. You know, I thought I was going to go down a different career line.
Yeah.
But I think it's really grounding. It could be argued that you don't need to spend 3-4 years grounding yourself at a university. Mm. You know, maybe you'd be better off getting on with, you know, learning some practical money-earning skill. Yeah. But, you know, I think it is, you know, if you apply yourself and chose the right direction of the courses available,
sure.
I think it is an attractive thing to employers. Yes, a good history degree.
Yeah, yeah. I like to think so now as well. But you do hear kind of like, oh, they're doing arts kind of thing. I mean, you never hear, oh, they're doing medicine. It's almost like with an arts degree, it's almost like, not that they look down on it, but that maybe they kind of, they don't see it. They don't see the important parts of it. I think maybe just because so many people at one stage in this country were doing arts degrees. So it was almost like the market was saturated with people who had done arts degrees. And like within that, all sorts of different subjects. But yeah, I think history gets an unfair representation sometimes because there's an awful lot in it that people don't think to look at because all they think of is the people with the history degrees that never do it and then kind of just leave it by the wayside. So yeah.
Yes, well, I mean, I have my two little daughters who've already said that they wanted to be artists when they grow up. And I'm like, okay, sure, you don't want to be chartered accountants or something. And my eldest daughter has recently said she wants to be an artist and a historian. So there you go.
That's good.
In danger for another generation.
say someone was to say to you, Turtle Bunbury, I really want to be a historian. What should I do? I mean, what kind of advice would you give them? Say one piece of really important advice. What would that be?
I think it really is. But what I said earlier is just tackle every aspect of how you present it through the social history, through the TV, radio. Do you want to write a book? And you've got to balance it up a bit. Like writing books is actually not a very lucrative sport, but what it does is it gets your name out there that maybe might get you a talk.
Absolutely,
that,
yeah.
That might, in turn, get you a television appearance, which, you know, they all sort of feed into each other a bit. So I think don't, by no means, constrain yourself to one medium.
Yeah, sure, yeah. No, that doesn't make sense. You're very involved with lots of historians, and you said you had contacts and kind of with different Irish historians. Do you feel like... What kind of things do you feel like historians could do to reach out to more people and kind of get them interested? Maybe destroy the stigma attached to history that an unfortunate amount of people have, that it is boring, even though we know it's not. Do you think that there's a way that people could, as historians, reach out to kind of the civilians that aren't necessarily interested and kind of hook them?
I think what I was trying to do with the History Festival, which I literally, the only reason I stopped it was because it was so time consuming and I was involved in other projects. But I, you know, hopefully somebody else will run a History Festival. Who knows?
Maybe
yourself.
Yeah.
I think there is one coming down in West Cork this summer, actually.
Okay.
But that was, I basically was got together the academia. So I had a number of brilliant academics who came down. I had some of the wonderful history guys from media, like Miles Dungan from The History Show,
and yeah.
Patrick Gagan from Talking History on News Talk, brought these guys down. Then the local history groups, because they are two sort of conflicting groups.
Yes.
Where quite often they don't, you know, see eye to eye.
Yeah.
They diss each other a bit.
Yeah, they do.
But the local historians sometimes have the most amazing details of knowledge for the academics and vice versa. The academics sometimes can authenticate what the local historians have said. So they need to meet a little bit more. And then the History Teachers Association also came down because they have been very concerned about the fate of history on the curriculum.
Yes, yeah.
Which obviously is an endangered subject here in Ireland, which is shocking and definitely should not be. Whatever about studying at a university, I would be, you know, fairly hard on history being very important to people
big time.
Until the age of, you know, until you're 15, 16 at the least.
I know, so, yeah. Now, people will have heard this if they listen to the episodes in order for the 50 year birthday. I don't know if they do or not, but I actually released an episode on why history is important. And one of the big things was, I mean, people always say, oh, history is important because it teaches you critical learning skills. And my whole thing is, yes, that's true. But it also roots us in the world that we're in, and it teaches us, well, like where we came from, obviously. And there's huge value in that. And I think when people look at the likes of history and they say, oh, let's just get rid of it from the curriculum, and they have this kind of utilitarian view of what every subject is supposed to instill in you, I think it removes a lot of the value of your education. Because if you're not getting stories and life lessons from people that came before us, I mean, you said that you'd be very much against removing history from the curriculum, but is that the kind of argument you would use, or would you use a kind of a different one?
No, I think that's it. I think it's just building, you know, the structure from which you can actually analyze the past to try and give you a sense of, you know, what decades past or centuries past mean and why the 12th century is different to the 18th century.
Yeah.
You know, these are things that you actually, if you don't study history, you might not, just simply might not get.
Yeah.
And considering we all, you know, walk through buildings and streets and towns that were built during these centuries, you need to kind of know the background. I would add to that that obviously with every, I was talking to an English girl the other day who's very apologetic that she'd never learnt Irish history at school. But, you know, I would say in Ireland, we, you know, you don't necessarily learn English history.
Or you don't, learn, really.
Empire history, or even in Cork.
Yeah.
For instance, when I was doing that project down there, you wouldn't necessarily know that Cork, you know, made a lot of money on the back of the slave trade for a long period of time, because that's, you know, unpalatable and doesn't fit the picture. nor does the thousands and tens of thousands of Irish who prospered as part of the British Empire and the colonial service and so forth.
Mm.
It doesn't necessarily fit the narrative that the Ministry of Education would, you know, like the Department of Education would like you to, you know, follow.
Yeah, and like along the same line as that, I mean, we recently had the centenary of the 1916 Rising. Well, actually, it was like a year ago now. But I was very annoyed at the way it was presented, because you rarely got both sides. You mostly got it presented as a kind of a glorious event. I mean, you've written books on the 1916 Rising yourself, so... Mm. I mean, do you have any opinions on the way it was presented, or do you think, I mean, certain parts of it I feel were done well, but I feel like they didn't give enough dialogue to both sides?
I was actually thought it was quite balanced, I have to say. I mean, yes, probably, inevitably, it was going to be more in favour of the Republicans. Mm. We live in a republic. But I thought it was very balanced and quite maturely handled, I have to say. I was refreshed. Obviously, there's still, you know, you're always going to get radical elements that still cause trouble every now and then now because they, you know, are unhappy with how it was treated in some areas. But no, generally, I thought it was good. I gave a couple of lectures in the USA about it, and it was quite nice to give them the other side of the story because they hadn't really heard it, you know, either. And it is a lot more, you know, there's so many characters involved in the Easter Rising that were really larger than life people, and that were by no means fitting into any sort of small box of what it means to be a rebel.
I suppose what I would just, I think the whole thing that turned me off, I watched this TV3 documentary on it, and it was literally like Pat Kenny, who's like an Irish TV personality, and he's like a kind of a journalist kind of person, but he basically gathered a lot of randomers around and asked if the 1916 Rising was right, and then they said yes, it was, and that was like the conclusion.
That was it.
Like, we found it. Like, we turns out it is right, kind of thing. Look, these people say so. So that was kind of like, I was aghast after seeing that. So I think, and that wasn't even like that. Obviously, that doesn't represent the majority, but to me, that just, I was so horrified. Like that they got like random. Like, why not academics together, or why not people who are like, why not me? I would do it. I don't mind, kind of thing. So yeah, it's just, I think they're for me, I think I saw that and that kind of left a sour taste in my mouth.
I think what will happen is in now, because the amount of stuff that was written by local historians, by academics, that now what needs to be done is somebody to gather all that new information. Mm. It's masses all about the women who were involved and people who had kind of been written out of it, and indeed about all the British who died and the Irish who were in British uniform and all these different groups. And I would say it'll take you about 3 or 4 years to read that.
Yeah.
And then you can do a 28 series podcast on that in 2024.
Oh, I know, yeah. I already, like the 1916 Rising itself, it was stressful enough because I was doing it for the centenary, and I think that was 20 parts in itself.
Oh, goodness, right, yes.
Yeah, so, and that was in the midst of all that content coming out, so I didn't necessarily have the benefit of being able to make use of it. But maybe in the future, I was pleasantly surprised. I don't know about you, but I know I just said I can't tie myself down to a specific area of interest, but if I'm maybe somewhat interested, for example, I'm unlikely to ever do a podcast on the American Civil War, but if I was to investigate that, the way my brain works, it's like I become very interested, almost obsessed after a certain length of time. That happened with 1916, and it'll probably happen with projects I do in the future. Like, I'm toying with the idea of doing the Second World War. I don't know, I suppose this is kind of an unusual question in a way, but have you ever kind of by default had to look into an area of history? Maybe it's a tangent or what have you, but you didn't necessarily think that you'd be interested in it, and it turns out to be like mind-blowingly interesting, and you end up thinking to yourself, wow, I could run with this in so many other ways, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably a little bit fickler in my history, in the sense that every book I've done is actually a compilation of short stories, really.
Mm-hmm.
I did one called The Glorious Madness, which was tales of the First World War, basically the Irish involvement. But yes, as in that is a very good example, because when I started the book, I didn't know a whole lot about the First World War.
Mm.
By the tail end, my chapters are getting longer and longer and longer. And I, you know, became absolutely fascinated with what was going on in Gallipoli and the Dardanelles campaign and so on. And then you start, you know, again, reading memoirs of people. And it can go on forever.
So yes,
I think that absolutely happens.
So you mentioned the 1580s earlier on. Would that be kind of Armada related in terms of your interest, or...?
Yeah, well, and also it's the first Bunbury connection to Ireland with this guy called Thomas Bunbury. Who was, I think I said he was tied up with Lismore Castle, but the governor of Lismore Castle at that time was this extraordinary man called William Stanley.
Mm.
So William Stanley, not to be confused with another William Stanley, Lord Derby, who's doing the rounds. This William Stanley was a Catholic. In Queen Elizabeth's army, which is kind of an unusual thing.
Yeah, it is.
And he was also Thomas Bunbury's half-brother. They shared a mum.
Right.
And he had been extremely successful during the Munster campaign, when they devastated Munster and annihilated the Earls of Desmond and all their supporters.
Oh, yes, during the 9 Years' War kind of thing.
No, this is 1580s, actually.
Oh, 1580s,
1580s, 1580s. when you've got all these people like Sir Walter Raleigh, as I'm trying to learn to call him, and Sir Francis Drake and Humphrey Gilbert, and all these guys are doing the rounds. William Stanley, as I say, he was unusual because he was a Catholic, but that had its advantages. He was able to rally quite a lot of Irish guys to fight in the Elizabethan army.
Wow.
And he went up and down from the Wicklow Mountains all the way down the Blackwater into Kerry and did extremely well from his perspective.
Yeah.
And then when they were parceling it up and they were divvying up, I can't remember what it was, but basically Munster was divvied up between all the loyal henchmen who'd got it.
Right.
And also Walter Raleigh got 40,000 acres, for example.
40,000 acres? Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so Stanley, understandably, from Lismore, was sitting there waiting, thinking, wonder what I'm going to get.
Yeah.
And he got nothing.
What?
So he was a bit miffed by that.
Yeah.
In fact, he got posted to look after Deventer, which is in the Netherlands.
Yes, yeah.
He was made governor of this fortress over there.
Yawn.
And he waited, and he was like, God, blimey, this is not good. And then eventually he lost his patience, and he swapped sides, and he handed Deventer over to the Spanish.
Right.
On the eve of the Armada. And subsequently found out that Queen Elizabeth and her Privy Council had met to discuss Ireland, and the Queen had recommended that Sir William Stanley be made Viceroy of Ireland.
Oh, no!
So there's a big lesson to be learned there.
Yeah.
Anyway, far too late for him.
Yeah.
He transferred, and he became an advisor to Philip on the eve of the Armada. In fact, he advised that the Armada come in through Ireland.
Okay.
Rather than the route they took.
Mm.
And he remained out there. He was in Holland, and he was, what do they call, the Legion of Extraordinary... No, that's the Legion
Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen.
The Legion of... it was a sort of British and Irish Catholic Legion
that
numbered Catesby and Guy Fawkes and all those guys in their
ranks. Yeah.
And he was sort of involved behind the scenes in the gunpowder plot and remained over there and was a recluse and died in Ghent, I think, in 1621. But needless to say, the Bunbury kept his head down during all that time.
Yeah.
Suddenly his once influential cousin has disgraced himself. Or half-brother has disgraced himself.
Yeah. Huh, that's
so very colourful times.
Yeah, very much so. And how did you go about finding out that kind of information? I mean, where would you go to look for that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of detail about, the Armada is sort of one of the really written about events and again Guy Fawkes as well, so that's where I found out about his latter day stuff and then sort of pieced it together. I'd come across him, funny enough, and then to my delight worked out that he was a half brother of my ancestor.
Oh, very good.
Which pinned him in. So
yeah,
and I love that time. That 1580s is when they're all those guys, nasty as they were in Ireland, Gilbert Raleigh and Drake and so forth, but they're also going out to the new world and
this
extraordinary exploration, which is would be like people going off as astronauts to Mars now.
Yeah, I love the idea of that. I love the idea of there being like this mysterious new world. And I love hearing, I love reading about what they thought they would find there, like these giant monsters and not even like pots of gold or anything like that, but even just like this mysterious land. And even similar with the Scramble for Africa, which brings us into kind of Britain Goes to War kind of era, but the idea that at the middle of the unseen center of Africa that there was this monster there, and that there was this empire or this almost Pandora's box that once it was opened it would just overtake the entire continent and the Western powers would be kicked out. And I think references to that are really interesting because it's a supernatural view almost of things, and the idea that back then, that, I mean, I know it's not that recently, but it's when we think of that era we think of kind of maybe we think of like no nonsense kind of stiff upper lip of like imperialism and that kind of thing. But the idea that there was this kind of scary Pandora's box at the centre of it waiting to be opened, I thought was always fascinating.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And all of it taking place after the US Civil War has resolved that we are all equal.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly everything goes into a backslide there for big old Europe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, another thing, I mean, the Scramble for Africa itself, Africa went from very little interest from Europe to suddenly kind of overwhelmed by European colonies, to the point that by the end of the 20th century, by the end of the 19th century, there was literally Ethiopia was like the only independent country. I just thought that massive transition was just like, I mean, where has that happened anywhere else? It's
I should think it's probably happening in Africa again right now, to be honest.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, like, relating to the Scramble for Africa and that kind of era, you found, or you were pointed towards the podcast Through Britain Goes to War with Gladstone and Disraeli. I mean, does that kind of political relationship have a kind of interest? Is that interesting to you in a kind of personal history sense? Or
It is. I was at a school in Scotland that was founded by Gladstone, so I've always, you know, had one eye on him. I think my ancestors were of the opposite persuasion to Gladstone. I'm quite a fan of Gladstone generally. I think he's quite, you know, really well. He obviously chopped and changed a bit, like all politicians.
Yeah.
But my family connection is through, well, in a way, is through a guy called John McClintock, who was from County Louth in Ireland. And his grandfather had been his father was sergeant at arms in Grattan's Parliament in the 1790s.
Right.
And his grandfather was an MP for Belturbet and Enniskillen. Anyway, this younger John McClintock was made a baron by Disraeli.
Oh, I see.
Benjamin Disraeli during his very short ministry in 1868, when he had climbed to the top of the greasy pole.
Yes, indeed.
So I was that was all that era of Abdullahites and the Reform Act and all that stuff. So, you know, it was set against the backdrop of that, and they basically had some vacancies. In fact, it was after Lord Palmerston's death.
Oh, okay.
That they had a vacancy to create a new Irish peer.
Right.
And so they decided to change him to Lord Rathdonnell, and he became the first Lord Rathdonnell. And for better or worse, my father is the fifth Lord Rathdonnell.
Oh, really? So Well.
Not a direct descendant, but passed to a nephew and on down through that.
Oh, very interesting, yeah. I mean, what I found when I was looking up Britain Goes to War eventually, I think it's kind of, anyone who listens to this with any kind of sense of awareness will notice that I had an idea for it when I began it, and then I just kind of got, I don't think overwhelmed is the right idea, but kind of so interested in British politics in the late 19th century, which I never imagined I would, like, get interested in. But I think the Gladstone-Disraeli rivalry is just so fascinating. Do you think there's any kind of, any, like, equivalence in history of the Gladstone-Disraeli? Do any come to mind, or is it just kind of one of those once in a million times?
Oh, I'm sure there have been, but that one is just because it played out for so long.
Yeah.
How long did it last? 20 years?
A good 20 years, yeah.
And I think there's quite a lot of colour, and they're just clearly so poles apart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's great, and I'm really looking forward to going back into it as well, because we last left them in 1880, so. And unfortunately, Disraeli isn't long for this world. He dies a good. Yeah, Gladstone doesn't die until 1898. Same year as Bismarck, incidentally, so interesting, yeah. So I think before we let you go, I think I'd just like to ask, is there any kind of plans you have for history going forward? Is there anything we should be aware of that you have in the pipeline?
Well, I am going to keep going with all the aforementioned different angles, and I may have the occasional new angle. I'm exploring the possibility, as they might say, of writing a historical novel, or a novel which has a sort of historical subtext anyway, which could be fun.
Yeah, that would be good, yeah.
Moving into that world, I think.
Very good, very good. And if people want to track you down, where would be the best place to do that?
They will find me through turtlebunbury.com, so turtle like the animal, B-U-N for November, B-U-R-Y.com. Which is a website where I put a lot of my historical ramblings on.
Cool.
Or Facebook, Twitter. Those two, really.
Cool, yeah. Well, and one final question. Would you like some merchandise?
You're very kind, Zach. Thank you very much.
I have a bag right here that I'll give you as soon as it's finished up. But I just want to say huge thanks for coming on and for celebrating this fifth birthday of the podcast with me. Thanks a lot.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Zach.
Okay, what did we think of that? He's not too scary at all, is he? I don't know why I was nervous in the first place. Hey, we did well, I think. That was my first one-on-one interview with someone who was not Sean, really. And, like, in person, I mean. So, yeah, I think it went very well. And those are the kinds of things that will really help me stretch as a podcaster. Not just as a podcaster, but as a historian who, in the future, I would like to think, would be able to do more of these interviews with people who I wouldn't necessarily know all that well. I was delighted with how it went overall, and yes, I did have to make that joke about
turtles coming out of their shells and all that kind of thing. I know it sounded awkward in the actual episode and I debated getting rid of that, but that's the kind of guy I am. I make terrible puns when I'm nervous. And hey, even though he didn't laugh hysterically like I did, because I'm the one who laughs at my puns, I mean, who else will? He did smile, and that was enough for me. So, because I knew he didn't hate it, I kept that in there. But yeah. So yeah, Turtle Bunbury, he's a great guy. And remember, you can let him know what you thought of this. And you can also support him in his work, because he is making history thrive just as much as I'm trying to. So go to turtlebunbury.com. Even follow him on Twitter. Tweet him, at Turtle Bunbury, and let him know what you thought of this guest appearance on When Diplomacy Fails. We really appreciated him. I really appreciated him. And I'm sure that my downloads will appreciate him too, because this is hopefully the first of many renowned historians that will appear in the When Diplomacy Fails podcast feed. But until that happens, this has been the Turtle Bunbury collaboration. My name is Zach, and you're listening to When Diplomacy Fails, because we are running wild. There'll be more episodes to come. Way more episodes to come, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be talking to you all very soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.